Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. My name's Paul Henley. In a minute, a report of a recent massacre in Ethiopia. We'll hear from the head of the Human Rights Commission there, who oversaw the investigation. And in 30 minutes, we'll speak to Atul Gawande, the doctor and writer who's been appointed to US President-elect Joe Biden's coronavirus task force. As concerns are expressed about people travelling home for Thanksgiving this week, we'll find out what his plans are.
I've changed my family plans for both Thanksgiving and Christmas, where we were bringing people together from around the country. And that's simply not feasible. We're still in a phase of uncontrollable spread. And it's going to take us through the next 4 to 6 weeks to really push that down. And we just haven't pulled together to begin doing that yet.
That's coming up later. First to Ethiopia, where the National Human Rights Commission has accused a youth group from the Tigray region of being behind a massacre early this month, in which it says more than 600 civilians were killed. The alarm was raised days afterwards by Amnesty International, which was unable to say who was behind it. But it's thought many hundreds of non-Tigrayan residents of the town of Mai Kadra were stabbed, bludgeoned, burnt and strangled. Meanwhile, the central government in Addis Ababa is threatening a major attack on the region's main city, Mekelle, as a civil conflict, more than 2 weeks old now, shows no sign of abating. Later in the programme, we'll hear from the Red Cross on what it's calling a grave humanitarian crisis. First, Daniel Bekele, Chief Commissioner at the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission, on what happened in Mai Kadra.
So our investigation has found out that the perpetrators of this atrocious crime is a combination of players, which includes an informal youth group that identifies itself by the name Samri, aided and abetted by the security apparatus that was in charge at the time, which basically means the local police and the local militia, which are both part of the local security structure.
Have you also talked to members of the youth group accused and to the local police?
Yeah, the local police that was in charge has since then fled the area. You know, the area was an area of active hostilities between the federal forces and the local administration that was in charge. So the local administration that was in charge at the time of this atrocity has since then fled from the area. So they're not exactly there, and they cannot be reached, at least for now.
So you haven't spoken to any of the suspected culprits?
Not the culprits.
Tell us what happened exactly.
So this appears to be quite a very well-planned and executed attack against civilians on the basis of ethnic identity. And this happened in a context of the conflict situation between the federal forces and the Tigray regional government. And the local security forces were, retreating from the area they controlled, this area called Mai Kadra. It was in the course of this retreat that they organized and executed quite a heinous crime against the civilians just before they fully retreated and left the area. And they simply went on a killing rampage where they have deliberately targeted people on the basis of their ethnic identity, killings through stabbing, strangulation, beating, and some of them were shot to death. And we're really talking about a wide number of civilians, an estimated number of at least 600 people that have been killed in a very atrocious, very inhuman and cruel way, which might probably amount to crimes against humanity.
And in making its investigations, did your team have free access to Tigray and free movement within the region?
It is not throughout the whole of the Tigray region, but to parts of the Tigray region, which is known as the Western Zone. of the Tigray region that we had access to. And this particular incident we are talking about happened in the western zone of Tigray, and we definitely had unfettered access to that part of the Tigray region, which is now under the control of the federal forces.
And indeed, just so we're clear, how independent of the Ethiopian government are you and your organization?
We're a very fully independent national human rights institution. We are established by parliament and we do report to the parliament, but the government does not interfere in our work in any way at all. It's a group of independent experts who have been dispatched to this mission, and there has not been any government interference. And we are simply guided by nothing other than both Ethiopia's constitutional principles on human rights as well as international human rights standards. So we are absolutely independent.
And I understand that your report also singles out humane acts in the midst of these atrocities, where local people have tried to shield those in danger from attack.
That's absolutely true, and that's probably a very consoling part of this tragic story, because this was an ethnically targeted attack. But at the same time, it was very encouraging to see that across ethnic differences or irrespective of ethnic origins, people have really been providing protection.
What did they do?
I mean, they basically hid them in their homes, in the churches, in the farmyards, and they spent the whole night in the farmyard protecting their compatriots. And some of them even sustained injuries while trying to protect the people in danger. Despite these inhumane acts and atrocities, it was very consoling and encouraging that people were the keepers of their brothers and sisters, even in the most difficult circumstances.
That was Daniel Bekele, who's head of the Ethiopian Human Rights Commission. And later in the programme, we'll hear from the Red Cross, which has been helping those affected by the fighting in the Tigray region of Ethiopia. Now, a new report warns that Afghanistan is becoming a significant producer of the dangerously addictive and illegal drug methamphetamine, or crystal meth. Afghanistan is already the source of the majority of the world's heroin. But this research, carried out by the European Union's drug monitoring body, warns meth production could eventually become an even bigger industry. In recent months, there have been multiple international seizures of vast quantities of the drug, suspected of originating from Afghanistan, and with street values of tens of millions of dollars. Secunda Kemani reports from Kabul.
Under a busy bridge, nestled amongst the filthy water and discarded rubbish, a grim community of desperate men addicted to drugs. Some are passed out, others huddled together, inhaling white smoke through glass pipes. For years, heroin use has been a major problem here in Kabul. But now, many are turning to a new, cheaper fix, crystal meth. Kudadad has been addicted to both substances for the past 5 years.
When I first started taking drugs, most people used to take heroin. Meth was very rare. But in the last 3 or 4 years, meth has become a lot more common, especially amongst young people. If you look under this bridge, it's not a place for human beings. It's not even fit for a dog.
Afghanistan's poppy fields already produce the vast majority of the world's heroin. Now it's emerging as a major producer of crystal meth, another dangerously addictive illegal drug. The boom has been fueled by the discovery that a plant growing wild in Afghanistan can be used to make the core ingredient, ephedrine. Poor Afghans in rural communities can produce it in makeshift labs. One video we've been sent simply shows a bare room with a huge metal pot on the stove.
this is a classic ephedrine lab. It has all of the telltale signs. There is the waste water that is a byproduct of the process.
Using satellite images, a team of researchers led by Dr. David Mansfield from Britain has been tracking the growth of these ephedrine labs. They found more than 300 in one district alone.
The realization that you could produce methamphetamine from a wild crop in the mountains, this ephedra crop, has been a fundamental game changer. You've gone from the use of imported over-the-counter medicines at a high cost to being able to use a low price commodity that is growing in its abundance and simple chemistry.
In the past, the US has carried out airstrikes on suspected drugs labs, but they're so easy to rebuild, the campaign soon stopped. The Taliban, though, do charge taxes from the traffickers. On the condition of anonymity, one smuggler told us how it worked.
The Taliban say for now there's war going on, so it's allowed. But when the right time comes, they will stop it. They first collect a tax from the farmer when the crop is being harvested. Then there's another tax when the drugs are being transported.
There have been huge seizures of meth suspected to be from Afghanistan by the Sri Lankan authorities in the Arabian Sea and even as far away as Australia. There are warnings it could make its way to Europe too.
I think the analogy I use, if you can hide something in any item, we've probably seen drugs concealed in those items.
Andrew Parkinson has been leading a team in the Australian Federal Police, conducting a forensic analysis of the meth they've seized, including more than $50 million worth dissolved into mineral water bottles earlier this year.
And what we are seeing and what we are monitoring is an increase in methamphetamine coming from Afghanistan and the surrounding countries around there. So all the profiling results that we have received from these seizures indicates to us that the starting product is the ephedra plant. Obviously, that for us, that yields critical information.
Afghan meth may be going worldwide, but it's causing misery here in Kabul too. Back by the bridge, one man tells us he's been searching for his brother for months after he became addicted. Our mother died because of the stress, he tells me. With instability continuing, the amount of meth being produced and the number of lives being ruined is likely to rise.
That was Secunda Kemani reporting from Kabul. You're listening to the BBC World Service. Live from London, this is NewsHour. Coming up, we'll hear from KwaZulu-Natal in South Africa.
We're in Opondweni village. It's a simple life. Livestock graze on the lush rolling hills. Brightly coloured houses dot the countryside. Inside the large homesteads, families work the land together. It seems peaceful on the surface, but there are divisions and tensions here.
Those tensions are over the expansion of a coal mine. We'll hear more in just over 10 minutes. Here are the headlines. The US President-elect Joe Biden has introduced senior cabinet nominees, stressing that America's back and ready to lead the world, not retreat from it. Meanwhile, President Trump has held an unscheduled news conference to claim credit after the Dow Jones Index hit a record high. And donor countries have promised Afghanistan $12 billion in aid, but it'll depend on progress in peace talks with the Taliban. This is Paul Henley with NewsHour, live from the BBC. The French National Assembly has tonight approved new restrictions on filming and sharing pictures of individual police officers. The new law is meant to protect officers from revenge attacks, and it comes the day after a violent police dismantling of a migrant camp in the centre of Paris. France's Interior Minister described the way police cleared that makeshift camp as shocking. The new rule has sparked fierce opposition from those who say that it threatens basic rights. Natalia Pouzyreff is a member of the French National Assembly for President Emmanuel Macron's La République En Marche party. She voted for the measure.
I would like to stress that the present bill cannot be reduced only to Article 24. And it's about how we can structure the different levels of security forces, especially since we are getting prepared for large events such as the Olympic Games in 2024.
Critics say the bill will make it more difficult to report on police brutality and other infractions of the law. What do you say to that?